we've been exploring what is distinctive about Triratna Buddhism, or the Triratna Buddhist order and community. This is particularly leading up to a puja, or a celebration, of Sangharakshita, the founder of the order, on the 26th of August, which we'll be having at this class. Expressing appreciation for the work he's done to make the Dharma accessible to so many, and particularly for drawing out these distinctive emphases which make Triratna Buddhism different, in a way, a new tradition of Buddhism, very much grounded in the historical principles of Buddhism, but at the same time distinctive and relevant in a modern context. So we've looked at the Triratna Buddhist order and community as an ecumenical Buddhist tradition, in as much as Triratna Buddhism is inspired by and takes inspiration from all traditions of Buddhism, but takes teachings and inspiration critically, looking at those traditions and teachings from the perspective of what's helpful, what's relevant in a modern Western context. So an ecumenical, not identifying with any one tradition of Buddhism, but seeking or taking inspiration from all, but taking that inspiration critically. But it's a unified Buddhist order. So the order has one ordination for both men and women, and men and women are ordained equally. Women ordain women, men ordain men, which is unusual, Sangharakshita would say, not to say heretical in the Buddhist world, but certainly distinctive in this movement. And that the order and movement is open to people from all walks of life, irrespective of age, sex, sexual orientation, race, or any other distinction you could think of. It is open to all people equally. And it has a distinctive, we heard last week from Dayavadra, a distinctive emphasis on the arts and creativity as a means of fostering refinement and creativity in approach to ourselves, our lives, our practice, specifically to thinking of pleasure, finding refined sources of pleasure which are consistent with spiritual practice. And then this week we're going to be looking at friendship, which has always been implicit in the Buddhist tradition, but is particularly distinctive about this order and movement in that it is explicit as a practice, that friendship is explicit as a practice. And next week we'll be looking at right livelihood, or particularly team-based right livelihood, the Noble Eightfold Path, one of the core teachings of Buddhism in terms of the path towards the end of suffering. One of the limbs of that is that our lives, what we do in our working lives, should be as much as possible ethical and consistent with the training principles, the ethical training principles of Buddhism. And so next week we'll be exploring how the Triratna Buddhist order and community tries to set up conditions for people to work ethically, and perhaps we'll be hearing some of the experiences of people who have been working in Right Livelihood and trying to create work as a spiritual practice, work as a context for spiritual practice. And I'm particularly pleased to be able to do this night down here with this wonderful painting, because it features somebody that I feel particularly embodies the principle of spiritual friendship, and that's this figure to the, well, my left, your right, of the Buddha, and it's Ananda, the Buddha's chief attendant, for 30 years, maybe even longer, of the, right up until the last days of the Buddha, when he passed away and achieved his final parinirvana. And I feel very much that this figure, as we get to know him, will be quite clearly embodying the principle of spiritual friendship, fidelity, loyalty, and commitment that such a practice involves. But before we hear a little bit about Ananda, we'll do what we always do at this time, and we'll have a cup of tea. So, we have the figure of Ananda on the shrine here, closest to the Buddha, on my left, your right. And he was the Buddha's attendant for 30 or 40 years. And the Buddha looked for a long time for a suitable attendant. And it wasn't until he came across Ananda that he found somebody who had the right characteristics to be a suitable attendant. If you read the Pali Canon, Ananda is often the person who asks the question that makes him look a little bit of a fool guy. He always seems to ask the question that the Buddha says, "Say not so, Ananda, say not so." And in a way, the fact that he often asks that question, I think, is particularly significant. The difficult questions, the questions where he made himself vulnerable, the questions that seemed probably, when you heard the Buddha's response, quite obvious. But what it, I think, signifies is his trust in the Buddha, his confidence in their friendship. And one of these specific examples of where Ananda is corrected by the Buddha is where, after deliberating for a considerable period of time, he goes to the Buddha and says, "Lord, I think spiritual friendship must be at least half of the spiritual life. Say not so, Ananda, say not so. Spiritual friendship is the whole of the spiritual life." So when we have the Sri Ratna Buddhist order and community distinctive emphasis of spiritual friendship, it is an emphasis that is very much alive in the Pali Canon, in the original written down and originally orally transmitted teachings of the Buddha. The Buddha himself saying that spiritual friendship is the whole of the spiritual life. And the words for spiritual friendship are Kalyana Mitrata. So many people will recognize the words mitra, meaning friend, mitrata, friendship. And kalyana is a very beautiful, it actually means beautiful, beautiful, noble, auspicious friendship. So it's a beautiful, noble, auspicious friendship, which is the whole of the spiritual life. And as you read and hear about the life of Ananda and the Buddha, You get the sense that they had a very, very real, very heartfelt, deeply held, committed, devoted friendship. It's very much alive in the pages when you read through. And Ananda wouldn't... he was a man of remarkable qualities. He was a man of a very remarkable memory. In fact, we wouldn't have a Buddhist tradition if it weren't for Ananda. If it weren't for Ananda, there would be no Buddhism, at least that survived today. Well, I believe that. And the reason I believe that is that he had an agreement with the Buddha that if for any reason he wasn't present when the Buddha was teaching, that the Buddha, and this was a condition of him taking up the role of attendant, that the Buddha would repeat that teaching for him later, so he wouldn't miss any of the Buddha's teaching. He had the capacity, he had a photographic memory, as we'd call it these days, he had the capacity for remembering every teaching the Buddha had ever given him. And he had... So this later in, after the Buddha's parinirvana, resulted in a problem, because after the Buddha's parinirvana, after the Buddha's body had passed away, Ananda wasn't enlightened. But the first council of Buddhism, after the Buddha's death, was made up of all arahants, all enlightened beings. And your qualification for attending this council was that you had to be enlightened. And they realized they couldn't hold the council without Ananda, because none of them held the teachings in the way that Ananda did. And so there's this lovely communication between Kashyapa, Mahakashyapa, and Ananda, saying, Ananda, you've got to go and get enlightened. We can't hold this meeting without you. Which gave him an added impetus, and he apparently did eventually gain enlightenment between his foot leaving the ground and his head hitting the pillow one evening. There was the moment he gained enlightenment. And he arrived at the council, apparently flying through the air, showing off his new cities, his new powers. But perhaps we can see that there was some myth at work there. Maybe not. Who knows? So he, when you think of Ananda, when I think of Ananda, and when the tradition speaks of Ananda, he is known as the guardian of the Dharma. The guardian of the Dharma. He is the man who... for all intents and purposes, held the teachings of the Buddha. In real terms, often it's spoken that Shariputra and Mahamoggallana were the chief disciples of the Buddha. But I think it was Ananda. I think Ananda held, was the guardian of the teachings, he was the guardian of the Dharma, and in a sense was the Buddha's principal disciple. He spent these 30 to 40 years with the Buddha, and he did everything that the Buddha needed him to do. He organized meetings for the Buddha, he organized food, lodgings. He was basically the Buddha's PA in a certain sense, but more than that, he was just constantly with him, available to him, committed to him, serving him. And I think this is one of the first principal beauties of Kalyanamitrita, is this capacity to serve, our friends, to put aside our own needs and just do what is necessary for our friends. It's one of the particular qualities that Ananda had. His qualities were rejoiced in just before the Buddha's parinirvana. And there's this very, very beautiful moment in the Mahaparinirvana Sutta where he's bereft. He knows the Buddha's going to die. He He knows the light, as he says, is going to go out of the world. And he's sobbing, leaning against the post of the hut. He goes away from the Buddha. He can't take the possibility of the Buddha departing the world. And he goes away because he's so bereft and sobbing against the post. And the Lord is leaving the world. He who was so kind, not he who was so wise, not he who expounded the true doctrine, but he who was so kind. And the Buddha knows that Ananda should be around, so sends somebody to get him. And, so, and when he knows that he's bereft, he says, Ananda, have I not told you? Have I not told you that it is the nature of all compounded things to come apart? It is the nature of all things to end. You know, sob not. Don't be bereft. This is the way things are. And then there's a very beautiful passage where the Buddha rejoices in Ananda's merits. He appreciates Ananda very fully. And I've just noted some of the qualities that seem to be implied, which really do characterize this beautiful friendship, this beautiful friendship. So Ananda's qualities are his constant loyalty, his fidelity, trust and generosity, his loving speech and loving acts, his friendliness and even-mindedness, his patience. All of these qualities are implied in the Buddha's rejoicing. And I think they really do make up a very compelling image of what Kalyana Mitrata really looks like in real terms. So I thought we could just spend tonight exploring some of those qualities to perhaps get a taste in practical terms. What does it mean to embody those qualities? So one of the particular qualities that Ananda demonstrated was generosity, this willingness to serve, this willingness to give up his whole life to service of the Buddha, to being the Buddha's attendant, doing whatever he needed. And, if we think about generosity, in a way, I think to put it in a worldly context, it's rather like, you know, if we have a partner, and I'm thinking about, you know, Ananda making that agreement with the Buddha that if ever he was away and he wanted to, he didn't hear a teaching, then the Buddha would repeat it to him. I wonder what it would be like if we, or our partners or our friends, if we just committed to every day when we met them to just hear what they had to say, or hear about their day, or every little detail of what's been going on, and we just suspended any sort of need for us to have anything from that arrangement, and we just gave our time to hearing about our friends, to understanding our friends a bit more fully, our partners. I wonder, you know, if we sort of think of it like that, for me anyway, eventually there will be a little nip of, what about me?
Can you do it again?
There'll be a point at which I'd want somebody to listen to me. You never get this sense with Ananda. He just very freely commits his time, his attention, the fullness of his attention. In a way, he's given his life to the Dharma. He's given his life and limb, even, to the Dharma, and to the service of the Buddha. He's given his time to the Buddha. and in the service of the Dharma. And it, as such, he's become the guardian of it. He became the most well-versed, the one who has heard most, heard much. Often in the sutras, the arahants are often spoken of as having heard much. It refers to Buddhism being originally an oral tradition. So if we can think of it that way, I feel immediately stretched by that. I feel a little, well, quite stretched by that idea. I still want a little bit of pleasure for me, or what I call, what we must call me time, downtime. You never get that sense of Ananda. For some of you, he really embodies that sense of giving time, giving attention, giving. If he ever received a gift, he would give it away, because he didn't want to receive anything on the back of the Buddha's glory. He just wanted to serve. He just wanted to serve. So I don't know, how does that sit? Are we feeling stretched at all already? I think it's inevitable that just in the on the basis of generosity is the first principle, in a sense the root of all positive qualities, that sense of just giving our time, giving materials, giving life and limb, and ultimately giving the Dharma, as the first principle of all positive qualities. And there's a list of a few more yet. So we feel a bit stretched by that, yeah. Okay, good. So I think about these qualities as like the external dimensions of friendship. The external dimensions of friendship, the obviously observable ones. I remember being helped, I think that's a good word for it, a long time ago when somebody was trying to be generous to me. It was Mahananda, in fact. I don't know if any of you remember Mahananda. There's a beautiful stupa for him on the shrine upstairs. It's the one with a 50p in it and all kinds of
golden one.
Golden 50p. It's a golden stupa on the shrine. He was a wonderful man and very fully enthusiastic about helping people. We were doing some outreach once in Stratford. We were running, Maitreya Bandhu was running a meditation course, and at the end of one of the evenings, Mahananda decided he was going to give me the flowers from the shrine. I was like, no, I couldn't possibly have the spiritual flowers. Who am I to have the spiritual flowers? I can't possibly take those home. And I was making a bit of a meal of it. I was making it very difficult for him to be generous. And Rat Nagosha, who used to be the chairman of this centre, is now in Cambridge as one of the directors for Windhorse, came up, very firmly put his hand on my shoulder and said, "Never block the flow of metta." Very full communication. I'll take flowers, pop down. But we can do that, can't we? We can be very self-conscious about allowing people to give to us, or allowing ourselves to receive. And it's just worth reflecting that it's not only about giving, our ability to give, but it's also about our capacity to receive generosity. And what's distinctive about generosity, and when a spiritual community, when Kalyana Mitra is really alive, is this constant flow of giving and receiving. And it's very beautiful. It's in a way, all our needs are met in that constant flow of giving and receiving of generosity. But we need to act on those impulses to be generous, and at the same time to allow ourselves to receive generosity with grace. with good grace. So perhaps that's an important practice. When we teach the introductory course, we encourage people to perform a generous act, and it's a very interesting thing to be conscious of. To be conscious of what effect it has on you and what effect it has in the world, and to learn from that, to learn about our responses, to learn how we are around generosity. So perhaps that's enough said there. So the next dimension of friendship, I think, which keeps friendship alive, is loving speech. What's called loving or harmonious speech. You can see these are ethical principles. Generosity is a positive precept, ethical precept. Truthful speech, but also loving speech, is one of the 10 positive precepts, or helpful speech, harmonious speech. And you can see that very commonly through the tradition of Buddhism, and particularly in that example where the Buddha was exemplifying loving speech and his rejoicing of Ananda. And Ananda rejoicing, or at least in a sense of even when he was bereft, finding the positive quality to reflect on about the Buddha, he who was so kind. And in a spiritual community where Kalyanamitta is alive, to consciously, specifically bring forth somebody's positive qualities is a beautiful act, and a very helpful and beneficial act to keeping the principle of kindly, helpful, generous speech alive. Often the times we can be, we can sort of stop at saying, well, yeah, you're great, I really like you, or in our sort of daily lives, or we're not very specific, or, you know, they're amazing. We don't say what they're amazing at. So the principle of this type of speech is, you know, that we really focus on people's actual obvious qualities, and that we let them know. We exercise that appreciation of them. I had a very real experience of this when I came back from the ordination retreat, and we were invited to Pavaloka to talk briefly to the men who were training for ordination. And I was asked by Satyaraja to give a talk on Dharma practice at Gyaloka, with Gyaloka being the place in Spain where we go for 4 months to get ordained or a retreat. And for me, what was really the Dharma practice of Gyaloka was community and friendship. So I wrote a talk on spiritual friendship. Well, I had ideas about what to say about spiritual friendship. And fortunately, Sanghanath, who had been asked to write the talk about spiritual friendship, wrote Dharma practice. So it all worked out, unbeknownst to us, but it sort of magically worked out. And what was really alive for me when I had these five men in front of me was how fine they were, how remarkable they were, what beautiful qualities, all different qualities, all different types of men. Men I wouldn't choose normally to be friends with. But over the course of the 4 months, I saw remarkable commitment, real kindness, concern, integrity in these men. And it was really moving to be able to rejoice specifically in their qualities. It felt like the best thing I could do for them, to honour the remarkable commitment that they'd made to live their lives for the benefit of all beings. And it's so such a lovely practice when you can be specific about somebody's qualities. It means we've really seen them. And it helps. It helps take the experience of that connection much deeper, much, much deeper. So, and it emphasizes somebody's potential. It emphasizes particularly their positive potential. In a way, you could say that's the definition of Kalyanamitta, this noble friendship. It's a focus not on who somebody, not only on who somebody is, but who they could be. Who they could be. So a real movement, a real sort of sense of that this person really has a future which is replete with qualities, with real qualities, which are alive now, but are clearly growing. Qualities of kindness, mindfulness, for example. And so, yes. So let's just stop there and see if there are any perspectives or questions so far.
I found that I was asked to do the being generous one today in the beginner's course, and I found that having to think of something specific about people I cared about meant that I felt a lot less frustrated with them because I had lots of worries or expectations or burdens in my heart of what I wanted them to be and what they should be and what they could be, and then I'd stop and think about what they actually were, and there was lots about them that I loved and that I hadn't really noticed because I had this big fog of what I'd like them to be, something different or maybe in the future, and I wasn't really thinking about the lovely, lovely things I actually have right now. So that really helped. And I actually did it with a friend over Skype, and she said something that she noticed about me, like something back, and we were playing like compliment ping pong. Yes. It got ridiculous in the end, and we were just giggling our heads off, and it was really good.
Yeah. And what effect, does that have a particular effect on your friendship?
Yes, because she helped me also to see the things about myself. And that's a good thing to practice in general, to not think too much, or obviously being ambitious and having hopes for the future is a good thing, but to also be honest about where you are and to accept where you are. It's not easy, but it's really good for you.
Yeah. And so it's that practice of, you know, we're not making things up, we're not embellishing. It's truthful speech. It's something we've actually directly observed in the person, which points to more to their potential. It's like a quality that's going to grow. If only it was held in mind more and given more life, as it were. What we give our attention to grows. And often, particularly in the spiritual life, we need these beautiful, noble friends to point out the blind spots for us, to really point to the things that we're doing which are undermining our practice. And I'm particularly in Subhajamati's book, another plug, I'm sorry, but that's really alive throughout the book, is this communication with friends, and they're pointing out what needs to develop or grow or change, or just a perspective that's limiting or unhelpful. And when people are paying attention to us in that way, are really noticing what's happening for us, what we're doing in our lives and in our practice, and they can point it out to us in a helpful, loving, kindly way, sometimes in a strong way, if it needs that amount of energy. It can be really, really, it can really help us break through limiting views we have of ourselves, open up new avenues for practice, new avenues for exploration. So the spiritual community is characterized by this very kindly specific, pertinent, sometimes challenging communication. Okay, so it's not always easy. It's not always straightforward, but it's really worthwhile. In terms of growth and development, we need to know what our, where our blind spots are. We need to know what views we hold are limiting, and sometimes it's only our friends that can point that out to us. So this is something of the quality of that Kalyana Mitrata, that beautiful friendship. So then we have beneficial activity. Our friends help us. They do things for us. We show empathy. I think one of the most significant beneficial acts that we can do for ourselves or for the world is to have empathy. That sense of imaginatively identifying with somebody's experience. In order to meet them more fully where they are. The Buddha was a particular master at this. He was always able somehow to see what it was time for in terms of a teaching and making a teaching specific to the context or the person. Probably that's why there might be some contradictions, because when you're making teaching specific to a person or a context, depending on the context, it will be different. Depending on what the person needs, it will be different. So it may be an explanation why there are some apparent, as opposed to real, contradictions in the Buddhist canon, and certainly sometimes in the Triratna canon as well. Because things are appropriate for the time and context that the teaching occurs in. So in this noble, beautiful friendship, we're acting for the benefit of others. This is really what beneficial activity means. There's Ananda did this for his whole life for the Buddha. He acted for the benefit of the Buddha. And actually, by remembering the teachings, he held the teachings for the benefit of all. And certainly we're still benefiting from that. Particularly the example of this in the Buddhist canon is the Aniruddhas, where there are three monks living in the forest, and the Buddha goes to see them, and the park keeper stops the Buddha and says, please don't disturb these three recluses striving for their own good. The park keeper didn't know who the Buddha was. So Aniruddha comes out and says, no, let him through, he's our teacher. And there's this wonderful dialogue, and I really recommend it to you, where the Buddha draws out the qualities of friends working effectively together in the spiritual life. So he describes it as a blending like milk and water. Yes. And there's a comment from Aniruddha, why should I not put down what I mean to do and take up what my friend needs me to do? What a gain, what a great gain, what a boon to be living with such people in the spiritual life. And so this notion of service and the what it really means is the undermining of egotism. The lessening of our self-orientation and the cultivation of an other orientation, an orientation towards helpfulness towards others. So beneficial activity is another particular characteristic of this Kalyana Mitra relationship. And finally, for the external dimensions of friendship. It's exemplification, quite simply exemplification. So it's walking the talk. It's not only saying we'll do something, but it's actually acting on it. And it's acting with integrity. In a way, we in the spiritual life are trying to live out some real values around love, kindness, compassion, mindfulness, stillness, simplicity, contentment, generosity. And in a way, to exemplify this is to look for opportunities to live these values more fully. So are we feeling stretched at all yet? I mean, it is pretty demanding, isn't it? This particular grouping of qualities has a name. They're called the Sangharavastus. They're the means of unification of the Sangha. So if we want a spiritual community to thrive, then it's these qualities, these characteristics that really make the difference, that are really going to cause the Sangha to thrive. Sangharachita refers to the Triratna Buddhist order particularly, but also he means the wider community, as a network of friendships. Really, there's nothing holding the order together other than this network of friendships. There are institutions which we tend to coalesce around, but actually the order has nothing in it other than these connections and friendships based around common ideals, common values, and a striving around principles of Buddhism. So this Kalyanamitrita, you could say, as being the whole of the spiritual life, is characterized by the network of friendships that exist within the order. And I think, for me, I find that the most beautiful thing is hearing about those stories, hearing about people's generosity, hearing about people's striving, and their help and their aid to one another. There's a great deal of learning in it. And as I said, and it's really clear that that's the case, particularly in Sivadramati's book. Okay, enough plugging. Just before we move on, are there any perspectives or comments or hello?
Yeah, I just want to say something. I listen carefully to what you're saying about generosity, the flow of generosity.
Mm.
But I do want to say that it's not easy.
No.
And what I have experienced in the past, it may seem very ungracious, but I think when people seek to practice generosity, I can often feel that it doesn't feel very genuine, that I'm being objectified a bit because they wish to practice generosity. And I think that the whole idea of us all practicing and the flow going, which I certainly experience in retreats and things, is great. But I think it's a sort of a, how can I say, it's like false consciousness or something, that when people sometimes just try to practice it, it somehow feels, if they're trying on me, then I'm being objectified, that they're not quite coming from the right place. I think it's a very difficult thing to do, and they're trying, but it doesn't feel right. So I'd say that.
Do you have a sense of what would make it, what are the particular conditions that make it more authentic?
Well, I think for me it's recognition of me. You know, when you talk about appreciating qualities, I think that's fantastic because it's actually about this is something that I appreciate about you. But I think, I don't know the answer, but I think it's, in my mind, there's this leftover stuff that we're all dealing with where we're told to be good and somebody's trying to be good, which is why that title of Sivadramati's book is so fantastic.
Yeah.
And so somebody's trying to do it, but they're not recognising the person. You know, as we try to recognise people when we do metta-bhavana, they're not really recognising the person that they're being generous to, or they're not really, or there's this I'm trying to be good thing going on, which actually gets in the way. That's all I can say, really.
So there's something that I'm understanding, which is about knowing what that person needs, or if one can.
That's part of it. But also recognising their individuality is important. Knowing what they need, you might not know what they need, but it's kind of like not. I'm going to give you this, whether you like it or not.
Sure,
that can happen.
The imposition of somebody's do-gooding.
The imposition, yeah.
Yes. And in a way, when we start to practice generosity, it can be a bit clunky.
Can be.
You know, there's a certain grace, and it needs to be in the details. It might simply be just noticing, actually making eye contact with the person serving you at the checkout at the supermarket. You know, it doesn't have to be an enormous act. It doesn't have to be life and limb, at least immediately. It can simply be just taking somebody in. On one of the introductory courses, one woman just said, actually, I'm just going to listen to my kids a bit more. You know, just take them in a little bit more. And it made an enormous difference to her relationship with the kids and their behaviour. Just by spending that little bit of extra time and attention. So it doesn't have to be material things. And it can simply be just the thing that's needed at that moment, if we can see it clearly. But we might get that wrong. Don't be discouraged. We can, you know, it's a practice that's never done, that's always being refined.
One thing I want to add to what you just said, forceful giving of generosity is very similar to the forceful giving of being excited to see somebody. What I mean by this is when you see certain salespeople, you see a fake smile, or you see them fake, they're excited for you, but you can feel it's fake. From my experience, is in those moments, I'm saying, is that I don't take it personally. Because I feel where they are, and understand them, and I just try to offer them my generosity of just understanding them, feeling them, and appreciating that they are trying. It doesn't affect me necessarily. And that's trying to turn it back on them, offering my generosity to them. That doesn't help me buy from them.
Well, I think also it's good to be aware that when somebody does show their appreciation for us, sometimes it can be so felt, it can really fumble. It can be awkward. I know this particularly from the first time I expressed my gratitude to Bhante. I recently wrote about this. And I stood in the queue waiting for him to sign my book, What is the Sangha? And whilst I was waiting with my palm getting more and more sweaty, I was like, what do I say, I've no idea, you know, it's him. And I handed over this book, shaking, sweaty hand. I can't for the life of me wondered why I was so nervous. But actually, it was just, I felt so much gratitude. I felt so profoundly grateful for the change that I've been able to make in my life as a result of his teaching. And it was really awkward. It was really awkward. So I just sort of mumbled. I suppose the most appropriate thing to say would be, thank you. It was not what I wanted to do. It was just completely fumbled. So he was signing the book very mindfully and put it back. And then he just looked up. And clearly, I think he'd got the authenticity of it. And he looked up, he fixed me with very, very bright eyes, smiled broadly and said, "Thank you." And it was almost as if my fumbling attempt at generosity had been taken in, really received, amplified and given back to me 100 times more powerfully. And that's what happens when generosity is really working. It's sort of like you get this thing back to you and you give it away again. It comes back to you bigger. Because more of that, the more that's practiced within the community, the more alive it becomes. In that experience, I sort of almost had to step back. Because the fullness of the attention and the delight and the joy which he expressed was a bit much for me. But for me it was a moment of conversion. You know, at that moment I had real confidence in him. So sometimes, it's just worth being aware that sometimes when people express their gratitude or generosity, it can be a bit awkward, a bit clunky. Because sometimes the feelings are strong. And we can just receive that with good grace, as you said.
Mm. And I have a question for you.
Yeah.
You said that, what about me?
Yeah.
I completely get what you mean, but what's the Buddha's teaching about it?
In terms of?
I mean, generosity is amazing.
Yeah.
And for me, you know, I'm lucky enough to be able to offer it, generally speaking. But sometimes a lot of stress happens in my life.
Mm.
Just get out of contact with who I am.
Mm.
And I become to a mindset of what about me?
Mm.
It's, you know, in one way, like you say, it's always there in the background.
Yeah.
But what are we supposed to do?
Yeah.
Eliminate it, accept it, live with it.
I think the most important thing to recognise around that is what our general tendency to do is to overemphasise me. It's not a practice where we ignore me, it's not that we negate me, but that we have, or we work towards a more balanced perspective between me and other. Yeah. So most of the time, there's a lot more me-ing going on than othering, as it were. And so the principle, rather like, and I suppose the practice would be the metta bhavana, where we're including us, but also balancing that selfing, as it were, with a concern for others. So the practice includes us, it's not negating us, but it's just trying to put more balancing to the arrangement, where we're not so obsessively concerned with me being the centre of everything.
And what about, as you were saying that he didn't...
He was the very advanced practitioner.
But you were saying that he was completely selfless.
Yeah.
And you were saying balancing.
Yes.
So how does that...
I mean, you can see that in the life of the Buddha. Often, there are a couple of examples, actually, where he would say, "Actually, I'm feeling really tired. Ananda, can you take over teaching?" So he knew what he needed and what it was time for. And he just made space for himself. But that wasn't from the basis of... a selfish concern. That was just from acknowledging what the essential need was, and it wasn't that he was over concerned with himself, if you see what I mean. So you can still make room for what your needs are. In fact, it's desirable in a practice of generosity, in a practice of metta, to have a good sense of what your needs are in the arrangement, but not to overemphasize those, not to overdo them. You sort of mean? Does that make sense?
It does.
So, generosity or metta includes us.
I'm still a bit confused about Amitabha.
Yeah.
In the sense that what he was doing was it.
So what he had done is he'd committed his whole life
to something else.
To
somewhere else. Or all
the
people.
Spiritual life. To the service of the Buddha. And that he recognized that his basic needs would be met by that. The basic needs for food, clothing were met by the laity. And what he perceived as what he needed in order to make his life comfortable was very little. In a way, the spiritual life is often talked of having more and more of less and less. Yes? So what we think we need in order to make our lives comfortable or manageable actually is much more usually than we really do need. And I think what Ananda and most of the original monastic tradition, perhaps, I don't know, I wasn't there, had realised is that their very basic needs only needed to be met. And all the other energy they had was not devoted to the pursuit of, I don't know, internet or music or other pursuits. It was simply 100% going for refuge to the Dharma and the Buddha. So what they perceived as what they needed was very much less than what I think most of us, myself included, think we need in order to make life manageable. But what the Buddha is saying is we need much less than we think we do. Yeah.
So can I just ask, is it this Ananda with his enriching his spirit through only making do with very, very basic needs? Coming back to the point you mentioned earlier about needs and context, he could enrich in his spirit, he had the capacity to do that, because materially he was less and less, and spiritually he was getting higher and higher.
So
one's going down, one's going.
So as we... So there's a move in the spiritual life, which we could perhaps say something about here, which is a movement from a dependence on material things to a reliance on qualities. So as we progress in the spiritual life, we need less and less external things because our experience itself is that much more satisfying. So we don't need so much in terms of material or outside interests to occupy ourselves as we become more replete with qualities. And then that movement from qualities becomes, or concern for qualities, becomes a concern for truths, concern for the Dharma. So there's this move from the reliance in the material world and the need for to be occupied and the need to have stuff to be interested in to a real appreciation of qualities and our experience in itself being satisfied. Yeah? So we, in a sense, we become so replete with qualities as we develop mindfulness, metta, as we our appreciation of nature and beauty develops, as our relationships with our friends grow and develop, we need much less in terms of material stimulation, external to ourselves, in order to feel satisfied. And then eventually, that orientation towards the way things really are becomes the predominant factor. And so we move from that dependence on qualities, that reliance on qualities, into reliance on truth, on reality, as we develop in the spiritual life.
I think the best lesson I ever learned about that and generosity was at Christmas in 2010. And I had one Christmas celebration where we had turkeys and baubles and a mice, like a gigantic Christmas tree and all the trimmings. And the meal was eaten in silence, the presents were given in silence, and in the middle of dinner someone said, my marriage is falling apart, and that was all that was said, and it was awful, it was just horrendous. And then I was taken to a student Christmas celebration, and I think we had wine in mugs that was warm and came out of a box, and we had fried cheese, which is actually really nice. And I think we gave each other like made things and jokes and insults and dares. And I sort of, like, this is really cheesy, but understood that Christmas is meant to be about friendship. And all these other things are meant to be symbols of love or closeness or fun or happiness, and that those qualities could exist even if it was just a fried cheese sandwich that you were giving someone. So it was like, it was rediscovering the qualities underneath the symbols that we were giving and what generosity was actually about. It was about being present and being loving and being kind and being really warm and actually paying attention to what the other person across the table from you wanted and needed in that moment. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I think we can get something of the spirit of that being on retreat, perhaps. You know, as we live a more simple life on retreat, and yet we seem to be just as happy, in fact more happy in a certain sense. I don't know if anybody who's been on retreat might see that, but as we practice mindfulness and metta, as we develop that momentum in our lives become richer as a result. We know our capacity to see becomes more vivid. Colours look brighter. It's almost like our experience, by default of developing that awareness, becomes more satisfying quite naturally, quite spontaneously. And the idea of going on the internet feels a bit strange. Well, it does for me anyway. So, I mean, maybe that's something of the movement that I'm talking about. Did you have a question about that?
I totally get this teaching about generosity. And as an ideal. But hearing it, I kind of think of my life, sort of the real life, yeah? I mean, and I'm reminded of this friend of mine who is an ex-manicure dresser and who's now on medication. And if I have too much time for him, I will be totally spent in the communication that this person is able to continue and continue. In fact, there's a lot of people, I mean, this person particular had a medical situation that made him very exhausting to me. But there's other people in my surroundings where I know, I have a mental note where I say, if I give that person too much of my time, I will walk away totally drained. And I'll need quite a bit of time to recover from that. And that is not generous towards myself.
Exactly.
And I find it very difficult to notice this voice in myself to say, I've been now generous enough in this situation, it's time to come back to me. Or it's even time to protect myself. For example, there are people who are always late. And it's really interesting what happens in my mind while I'm waiting for them yet again. And what's going on in my mind, it's like, so it's easy for me to say, I'm going to make my generosity practice to just wait for them. That's how they are, and I will accept that. However, there's a part of me that's boiling up, and I just wish I could just say, next time, don't be late. This is a problem for me. I feel like you're taking the piss, quite frankly. Yeah, that's how I feel. So, this shift that we make from the act of generosity towards sort of saying, no, I'm now going to put myself first. To protect myself or to be kind to myself.
It's
what can I do about
it? It's actually a reasonable thing, spiritually speaking. In fact, not to do that might be considered spiritual laziness. And that's quite a bold statement, isn't it? But actually, you're exercising awareness of what your capacity is. And you're not going to be helpful to somebody when you're running on empty. When you haven't got the capacity to meet them. More often than not, I find this when I'm looking after patients. If I'm running on empty, my empathy is not going to be firing on all cylinders. And actually, sometimes it's absolutely necessary to take stock, a step back, and look after yourself for a while in order to develop and refuel that capacity. the key thing about it is that the more you practice, the greater that capacity becomes to be with others, to attend to others. And but in the practicing, in the developing, we also need to exercise awareness of what it's time for with regard to others and ourselves. It's a balanced perspective we're aiming for, that includes us. To not do that actually results in burnout. I have a real experience of burnout, and it took me a number of years to recover my love of caring, because I hadn't looked after myself. I was useless to people. And so this isn't a practice of self-negation. It's a practice of the emergence of qualities and capacities through developing mindfulness, metta, and awareness that naturally evolve. And that sometimes we push out beyond and we find, I've pushed it a bit too much. I need to step back for a while. So these qualities are developed over time, are the natural byproducts of awareness, mindfulness, and metta. But when we're looking at the capacity to look after or be kind or be generous to people, they're natural expressions, spontaneous expressions at their best. And when they are natural and spontaneous, they feel effortless. Actually, most of us don't experience that. That's not my experience most of the time, but sometimes it is. And it's almost as if it's not me acting when that's the case. You're just in the flow of experience at that point. But yes, the very important thing to take home is we're not exhausting ourselves in the practice of generosity. We're not reaching out beyond our capacities. We're looking after ourselves as well. I think it's very wise to consider yourself in those situations.
You know, going back to the example of being late, somebody being late, and which I very much identified myself in. And what to do about that struggle, because you don't want, obviously you're trying to practice your kindness, but as he said, there's a part of me boiling. So I sometimes it can explode that part and I find myself in a real conflict then, because it's something very trivial. It's somebody being late, it can happen, but...
Well, in a certain way, it's taking and not giving, isn't it? Somebody's taking time that's not really theirs, and they're not, in being late, unless there's a really good reason, then often it's a little inconsiderate. We might accept their apology if it comes, and we just have to work with that. But could we talk to people about it? Could we say, it's difficult for me when you're late. I don't know whether you're coming or not. Can we actually get into that communication about what your real need is? And what's the view that we're holding that actually works into that irritation and boiling? Is it, I'm not feeling cared for, but they're not acknowledging how important I am in life? Or what is it? That's a slightly sort of bold statement, but what is it for you that is triggering that sense of boiling? So there's a piece that we're doing around our needs, and then there's the feedback discussion that we can have with our friends. An alive spiritual community is full of that type of communication. That's the challenging part. So perhaps something around there. I'm afraid we have to stop. We have to stop. And there is more to say. Friendship, being the whole of the spiritual life, is an enormous area of exploration. And I just think, to finish, I think what we're trying to do, really, in moving from ordinary friendship into spiritual friendship, is that we're trying to move from seeing people from the point of view of our likes and dislikes and utility and usefulness. And then sometimes in real friendships, in our friendships, we see something else. We see communication of real meaning. You know, we sat round that coffee table and we haven't known what the time, where the time's gone, because we've been so engaged in that really meaningful communication. It's been beautiful, it's been effortless. And it's moving into that arena whereby we're really our communication really means something. Our generosity, our kindness and consideration, we hold our friends in mind. We're moving from the particular to the non-exclusive, to the universal. Rather like in the Karanar Metta Sutta, we're moving from this sense of me being the centre of the universe to out towards all beings, as if they were our only child. You know, that sense of the mother having the concern for her only child that's spoken of in the Metta Sutta, that we would have that concern for all beings. It's a tall ideal. And like most Buddhist ideals, spiritual friendship is never done and can only grow, only be developed, through really connecting, committing and engaging. So maybe that's enough for now. Thank you.
Thank you.